With its abundant natural beauty, charming towns, and friendly people, South Carolina offers the kind of discoveries that stay with you long after you've left. Like the realization you're good at something you never before tried. Or your first oyster roast, and a taste you didn't expect to love. And other times, it just hits. Like the view on a windswept Appalachian mountaintop. So come find the undiscovered you in South Carolina. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Well, welcome back to the party. If you have not been part of the Delphi Richard Allen saga over the last several years, well, there's a lot to take in. If you're new, there's plenty of time to consume it. We're going to go through where things are at today. Richard Allen's appeal is now fully briefed. Three judges in Indianapolis are reading the state's response and the defense's reply. And the most striking thing about the state's response isn't what it argues, isn't what it does. The defense raises a van timeline contradicted by FBI cell data, a confession to shooting two girls that were killed with a blade, and an alternative suspect whose interview was allegedly recorded over. The state's answer to most of it, which these are rather large things, they don't just seem like it, they actually are. The state says, harmless error, paperwork, waiver, nothing to see here. Move along, everybody. When the prosecution is sitting on a conviction, they have to win on procedure rather than facts. The question then stops being whether Allen got a fair trial and starts being whether the state is even trying to defend the trial that it has. Bob Mata, defense attorney, as always, is with us, who's been with us from the beginning on this case, has educated us on this case a thousand ways, and the saga just continues. Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, with us as well. Bob? State's response is built on harmless error and waiver, not on actually answering facts that the defense raised. So when you have a conviction in hand and you're fighting back with procedure rather than evidence, what does that tell us about what's going on here?
That the evidence is the worst place for them to fight.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that simple. When they've got that conviction on lock, you know, their playbook is going to be to keep the judge's panel as far away from the trial record as humanly possible. Mm-hmm. Because when you start throwing the waiver thing out there, the harmless error, that's going to require them to get into the weeds a bit, right? They're going to have to get into the record in order to determine, okay, yeah, there was an error here. Gull should have let this in. But the fact of the matter is it's harmless because it wouldn't have changed anything with respect to what the jury ended up doing in terms of coming back with a guilty verdict. So, but the waiver thing is a whole thing. Like that, like when you're reading through that brief, if you haven't read their response brief, just keep that in mind when you're reading it. When you get into kind of every single section that addresses Allen's brief and they start it with waiver, that tells you all you need to know.
Let's talk about the waiver. Help the audience understand what the waiver is and what it means here.
Okay, so waiver is essentially the argument that at trial, that because the defense failed to object to either certain things being introduced into evidence or certain things being said, and if they didn't do that at trial, they didn't renew the objection, okay? Because if you follow Delphi from the beginning, you have a clear understanding that they litigated all this stuff. We litigated, you know, the third party culprit stuff. They did all the motions in limine about trying to get the composite sketch in. All that stuff was litigated pre-trial. What the state is saying, well, that's well and good, but the fact of the matter is that you have to renew that objection at trial. Otherwise, it's waived. And when we use the word waived, that means it goes away and the court, the appellate court, can't address it because it's no longer an issue because it was not properly preserved.
Okay.
Yeah, Bob, the thing that keeps striking me with this, because again, I do not have the massive legal brain that you do on this. I know we as a collective, you probably have seen more that are that have kind of come to this level of incompetence, but maybe not. How come there's not better checks and balances in here for what looks to be, and again, is this subjectively gross negligence it looks like, or was it, is this really as bad as it looks from the outside as it is, as it is on the inside? How come there's not a better lever they can pull on this? Because as I'm looking, again, I can be off on this, but when I'm looking at the probabilities of success of retrial, it's still extremely low, even though it looks so high, or am I way off?
No, I mean, if you're looking at it kind of just as a layperson and
like me.
Kind of, no, I mean, look, you're pretty learned in a lot of different ways when it comes to the law, but in terms of kind of like appellate law, it's a different breed. It's different than watching a trial. It's completely, there's different rules. There's different standards. Everything's different right. when you're shifting from trial to the appeals process. So if you're looking at it ostensibly and you're like, wow, man, you know, they really should have objected to this, this, and that, because every old evidence law professor is going to tell you, you know, if you fall asleep at your counsel table, the first thing you do when you wake up is you object, right? I mean, you're just, right. it's a cover your ass type of thing. Ultimately, with respect to the waiver issue, and I don't know if you guys have been able to get to the reply brief, which was recently filed as mm-hmm. well, I think that the defense handled that with great aplomb. So I don't think that that's going to be an issue. I think they're going to have to get to the merits, because that's what this boils down to. It is, are they going to get to the merits of the case? Meaning, are they going to get to the errors that the defense is saying cumulatively all resulted in Richard Allen not getting a fair trial? So, and I think that the defense, in terms of the appellate defense, did an excellent job addressing kind of blow by blow all the different waiver issues that the state put forward. Because, I mean, look at it like this. Like, if you're making a waiver argument, you're telling the appellate court, look, we just saved you a whole bunch of time. You don't even have to get to the issues, because you could just say, you know what? Sorry, you didn't preserve it. We don't have to address it. Next, mm-hmm. you know, and just go down the line. And then ultimately, you know, they end up upholding the conviction, and then it gets appealed up to the Indiana Supreme Court. So, but I think that the waiver issue, which when you read, you know, the state's response, you're like, wow, man, they just shit the bed. But then when you read the reply brief, what they did is they went into the record, and they mm-hmm. showed that there were certainly sidebars that took place where issues were absolutely preserved. And, you know, they make very strong arguments that the law doesn't really support that position, because if we're trying to get to the truth, and I'm talking about the position of waiver, that you don't have to get to the merits, you want in the search for the truth for them to be able to get to the merits and see whether or not the guy got a fair trial. You don't want them taking the easy way out. If they look at it and they say, okay, well, this is the easy way out. This is a hot button case. And, you know, we know that there's a lot of eyes on it, and we don't really want to deal with it. We're going to have the conviction stand, and we've got the ability to be able to do it through the waiver issues. And the law tends to not really look kindly on that. I mean, the law wants us to get to the issues. So mm-hmm. I think there was enough done in the reply brief. And I'm not going to be surprised if this thing gets upheld by the appellate court. But then I think where they might make their hay is up with the Indiana Supreme Court, especially when it comes to the confession stuff. Right. I think the confession stuff is going to be of great interest to... Because, mm-hmm. I mean, it's such a slippery slope, and I know we're going to get to it, so yeah. I won't belabor the point now.
I just want to make sure I'm understanding this, you know, the same way that the audience is understanding it. Basically, it's being argued right now from the state's point of like, well, you know, you waived your right to bring these things up. You didn't bring them up effectively or the way you should have procedurally during the trial, and because you didn't do that doesn't mean you can do it now later. The argument from the defense is saying, oh, no, we did. You just didn't register this or accept this the way that you should have for it to be valid. So you saying we didn't do it is not a full truth. It's basically they're arguing schematics to a certain extent right now to say, I want to tell the full story, but are you allowed to tell the full story? Because according to the rules, you kind of did, you kind of didn't. We'd say you did. We didn't say you did. It's kind of stuck right there at this moment. And the state can still say, well, we didn't follow the rules, or you didn't follow the rules exactly, and we think you're right. So move on, folks. And then that move on might be to the Supreme Court.
If
on the where it's sitting right now, the state doesn't go, okay, let's hear you out. Let's hear some of those oral arguments. Which they might do.
They're going to do it. It's definitely the oral arguments are going to happen.
Okay.
Defense requested it. They're going to grant it. It's definitely going to go to oral arguments. But I mean, when you're talking about oral arguments, you're talking about 15 minutes per mm-hmm. side, basically. You know, it's very limited period of time.
You get a YouTube short to argue your point.
Essentially, that's exactly what it is. Because, and as soon as you're the appellate lawyer and you're kind of getting into your, just as you're getting into your rhythm, they start hammering you with questions. They call it a hot bench. I love watching appellate cases argued because it's such a back and forth. You know, this mm-hmm. is in a situation where you're going to have a lawyer standing up there yapping for 15 minutes. You're going to get maybe a minute and a half, and then the judges are going to start coming at you with the things that they want addressed. When they read the brief and then the response and then the reply, and they're left with some questions that they want addressed, that's what they start coming at the lawyers with. It's really, if you're interested in the court system in general, I highly recommend that you go and start watching some appellate arguments because they're fascinating. I mean, mm-hmm. it really gets down to the nitty gritty of the law. And, you know, what we're talking about here is just procedural, strictly. Yeah. We're not even getting into the merits of it where you're talking about, you know, what the applicable law is that's come down from the U.S. Supreme Court and what applies. And does this reach the level to where the judges are going to have to say, look, you know, again, cumulatively, Richard Allen didn't get a fair trial. It's like if we're piecemealing everything, maybe one thing on its own didn't amount to that. But when we look at all of it together, it's pretty obvious he didn't get a fair trial. And again, how they're going to address the very complex issue of the confessions is going to be the most fascinating part of it. I think that's where the oral arguments are really going to live in that particular issue. Mm-hmm. Because I think with the third party culprit stuff, you know, they're either going to agree with Gull that there wasn't a nexus, which to me is insane. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't see how that's a thing. And, you know, but the confession thing, because at the end of the day, and we've only heard from one juror, maybe two, so we don't really know what they're hanging their hat on when they decided that Richard Allen was guilty of this. And the one that I read a transcript for was saying that the confessions to her weren't that important. I don't believe that. Yeah. And I think the confession sit as the background to everything else. And, you know, like ultimately at the end of the day, if they're like, oh, well, it was the van thing is what pushed me there. But if the confessions aren't sitting there in the background, if they're not just ruminating in the back of their skulls, it's a different trial. It just is.
Yeah, because once you have that confession out there, then what you have is you have confirmation bias of them trying to prove what they've already come to the conclusion on because they didn't do a deeper dive on understand how that confession came about, what his state of mind was. Yep. And that's where everything lives. Like you said, everything's going to live when they go at those confessions. And I'm curious, Bob, you've been practicing a long time. I can't even probably estimate how many cases you've seen and you've seen appealed. How would you rank this as a just cause for an appeal and out of all of the cases you've covered?
I mean, I thought from the get, like my entire coverage, which I think Alice and I were really, you know, and then frankly, Tony, when he'd have me on the show, were the only creators out there that were following this thing throughout the entire pretrial thing, which is where all the nightmares happen. I mean, I saw it early on that there were going to be legitimate issues, you know, that were going to have to be addressed. And ultimately, you know, the problem, Robin, is that it is really, really, really hard to overturn a conviction in this country. It just is. Yeah. What they do a lot of times is they defend the conviction, the appellate courts, as opposed to kind of looking at it objectively, which is what they're supposed to do. But the way that it typically plays out is they go out of their way. And I'm talking about not Indiana specifically. I'm talking about all appellate courts. They really fight very hard to uphold convictions. And ultimately, it's going to go up again to the Indiana Supreme Court. And I think that the issues are so flagrant in terms of what they did with Richard Allen during his 13 months of incarceration pre-trial that they have to address it. It is not something that can become the norm, because if this thing slips through the cracks and this conviction is upheld and the Indiana Supreme Court says, you know what, we're good with it, and then that it moves into post-conviction act world, post-conviction relief act world, we're talking about a different thing, because that moves it out of the appellate court world. And it creates a very, very slippery slope in terms of what law enforcement and prosecutors' offices are going to say is allowable. Because essentially what they did is they put that guy in a solitary confinement for 13 months until he went mad, you know, and they used that to extract confessions out of him. How it was done, you know, because people are always like, oh, well, you know, he just started confessing. I'm like, all it had to have been is simple as when he's eating his own feces and smashing his head against the cell walls, and they've cut him off from person to person contact with 100%. The person that matters most to him in the world, which is his wife. All you have to do is say, hey man, you want this shit to end? Just say you did it.
I know. And this is from someone who is already suffering from what we're getting from hearsay anyway, right? Yeah. And you know, Nelson Mandela said it in his book, The Long Walk to Freedom, because he was incarcerated unjustly in South Africa for so long. He goes, you can judge a country by how it treats its incarcerated. And the fact that Richard Allen wasn't even convicted and he was treated like this while awaiting trial is just the most absurd, abhorrent thing that, again, and it's just like we were saying, it's just one massive data point which inspired confessions, not for his own benefit, but for his family's. And that's just one, plus the police mishandling of shit they kept losing, overwriting. I mean, it's
unbelievable.
And so you're saying that they're defending the process more than the outcome or the evidence or anything else. So they're just bent determined to defend that the process was correct. Yes?
Yeah. Look, I mean, when I read the reply or the response rather from the state, I don't see them really addressing the issues in a substantive type of way, you know, which is ultimately going to be potentially their downfall, because they didn't address it in the way that they should have, because they're relying on the fact that they waived all these issues. That's not to say that they didn't write some of the brief wasn't dedicated to trying to address the issues, but it's not the kind of legal analysis that you'd want to see if you're rooting for this guy to be remain convicted. You know, it's like you want them defending their position, defending the rulings that were made by the judge and why they were the right rulings, you know, because ultimately I just think that cumulatively that they're going to end up looking at it and saying there's just too much here. There's too much that went on with this particular trial for us to feel confident in the conviction. And in order for them to get there, you know, and I mean, if we really want to get into the weeds, and I don't know if we do or if we don't, you know, when you have the Nepui issue, which we'll probably get to on a different live, maybe as the appellate process moves forward and we get the oral arguments, it would probably be cool to do another live like leading into that, where we can kind of like pinpoint some of the issues. But the Nepui thing is a really interesting one. And that's a structural error. Structural error means we don't need to get to the analysis. You screwed up so massively that everything that that took place after it has been tainted, that there's no way he could have gotten a fair trial because you made this kind of a grievous error up front. And like, I think that that's a very powerful argument, whether or not it's something that the appellate court's going to be able to, you know, sleep at night by just saying, okay, we're giving them a new trial just based on that is where this thing lays, you know, because I mean, you're dealing with human beings, you know, you're dealing with,
yeah, with
appellate court judges that are up there, and you know, it's a thing where they've got people in their ears. We don't know what they're seeing or not seeing online. You know, it's one of those things, because you kind of hope that some of the appellate court justices are up there and they're seeing some of the stuff, some of the coverage on this case, you know, even though they have to limit,
yeah,
what their you know, response is going to be to the record. That's not how human beings operate.
When we're talking about this being a human being issue, I want to ask one more question in this segment before we go to the next one, and something we had just talked about. We're talking about the jurors, and very few have come out and said anything from this trial. Very few. A lot of cases, high-profile cases like this, you see them kind of scatter out all over, and they tell their story. Very few have said jack.
I know.
This. Reading the tea leaves, this is just pure conjecture. Bob, when they got off the jury, trial's done, they got a chance to really absorb the information. Hopefully some of them did in its entirety without the filter of gull in between. And they probably saw a case that looked very different than what was presented in that courtroom. That would be my opinion of what any objective person might see when they look at this. Why do you think not many of them are saying anything publicly?
I don't know. I always kind of wonder that when it's a high profile case and you're not hearing from the jurors, and where there's a lot of coverage out there that's really kind of highlighting a lot of the issues that they didn't hear or see at trial. You are left wondering, well, why aren't they coming forward? And, you know, you could obviously make the argument that that's an issue for them that they're not willing to address, because if they ultimately start to feel like they made the wrong decision and they ended up putting this guy in prison for 130 years based on things that they didn't see or hear.
Yeah.
It's a hard question to answer.
It's a bad place to be in. I mean, I'm not trying to shame them. They don't deserve shame. They did the job based on the information they were given.
Exactly.
And if you're only given a very blinder, half-assed version of the truth, I get how they got to where they got to. But at the same point, you know, it's almost like someone, it's like they've been victimized to a certain extent too. Victims of different crimes and things like that, predatory type behavior. And I almost feel like this is predatory in a way, the way this was presented to a jury, and said, okay, your decision matters. Never mind. We're only going to give you half the truth. And then you're the ones that have to deal with this the rest of your life for making this choice. To me, that is predatory. And shame comes along with that. Not necessarily rightfully so, but shame comes along with that. And I could see a lot of them having shame about it. And also, for their own best interest, I wouldn't want to throw my hat into the ring and have these discussions if I'm one of the people who made the decision to put this guy away forever. And now realize, oh shit, I didn't see all that. It's not their fault they didn't see it. I don't blame them. They didn't get it. But I could see that being like, yeah, I don't want to. I want to pretend this moment never happened to me if
right.
I were them. Yeah.
I mean, because you're sitting there. Imagine you're a juror and they're interviewing you, and they start throwing all these things at them. And they're like, well, you know, had you heard this, would that have changed your mind? Had you heard this, would that have changed your mind? And you're kind of forced to sit there, because if you talk to jurors in high profile cases that ultimately get flipped on their head somewhere down the road, or something comes out like DNA that is pretty definitive in terms of that this wasn't the person who committed the crime. And then they're forced to kind of address that with themselves.
Yeah.
Because people take that civic duty very, very seriously. And the weight of what they're doing in that room, ultimately, when they utter the words guilty or write it down on the verdict slip, they feel that because they understand that they have fundamentally changed just not one person's life forever, but everybody that's involved with that person. like their lives have been forever changed and altered in the worst way possible. And so for them to find out down the road after the fact, and again, like you said, to no fault of their own, they can't intuit things that weren't addressed at trial, right? And if they were being honest that they didn't know anything about the case or very little about the case coming in, then, you know, I mean, that's a lot to process for a juror, you know, and I get it. Like I probably wouldn't be running if I was in that position, I probably would be keeping quiet myself.
Because, I mean, it's really, I mean, it's how humans behave. I mean, it's why you have people that still defend predatory churches. It's why you have people that defend all sorts of institutions that, you know, in theory, when operating as, you know, constructed, are not bad things. But when they go off the rails and you still think they're operating as they should be, and you're bamboozled into it, it is good to stand up and say, this is wrong. I was bamboozled here too. And I do see the comment there of like cowardice, self-preservation. These people have lives too. They didn't necessarily say, hey, let me dedicate the rest of my life to Richard Allen's defense. They stood up and said, I'm going to be a juror on this trial, and were essentially bamboozled. So I don't blame them if they don't want to continue down this path and be a spokesperson for Richard Allen. But that is the reality. It's self-preservation. People don't like being wrong at the end of the day. And sometimes the solution to that is not necessarily dive into the pool again to see just how wrong you are. It's been to that pool before. I don't like the water. I'm good.
Yeah, the water was not the right temperature.
And so, Bob, again, I just want to clarify and definitely understand. So, and they were instructed, this is beyond reasonable doubt, correct, that they had to vote that they thought he was guilty.
Yes.
So, and that's where I love giving grace. I am extremely empathetic too, and that's why I think if I was having my conjecture about why we have silence is because they had to vote beyond reasonable doubt they thought he was guilty. And all you have to do is peek behind the curtain of what is going on outside that courtroom, seeing that there is nothing but reasonable doubt. And so facing the fact that you'll now have to confront people and try to defend how you had no, that you made your choice beyond a reasonable doubt, it's easily assaulted and hard to defend. So I'd say silent too.
100%. And the other part of it is, if we take into consideration if they did dive in to all the content online, they quickly realize that there's two warring factions here.
Yeah.
You know, and they're ugly. But, you know, both sides are very ugly on this case. Both sides are adamant about the way that they feel. And, you know, that's a big lever to pull if you're a juror.
Which comes down to the one confession. Seriously, is that where that dividing line is? Because I think everything else submitted was real complete bullshit when it comes to evidence. It really, as I understand it, it really came down to half the world believing that confession that he made, multiple ones, kind of varying a lot on details, and not believing it. Is that really at the crux of what you think that they based it on? Or is there other things like the shell casing that had nothing to do with anything?
Yeah, look, to me,
Or bullet, not casing, right?
Yeah, when I look at this thing, this is what I would classify as a narrative win for the state. Like they won on a narrative, they won on a story, you know, and the way that it shook out is that Gull protected that story. Gull didn't allow for the defense to bring in certain evidence that would have made that story questionable.
Doubt.
Because when you got the story that they have, which is, oh, well, Richard Allen, you know, he admitted he was out to the bridge, and words matter, right? It's like Richard Allen volunteered the fact that he was out there. He didn't admit it, but that's a tricky word, right? Mm-hmm. Because when you say admitted, that's indicia.
That's like
guilt.
You're like in a dark room. Were you there? Like, no, he actually called and said, "Hey guys, I was there. Can I help you?"
Right. And then you watch
that first. If you watch his first interview that he did with the law enforcement guys, that was someone that was completely transparent, truthful. Had a cell phone right in front of him. That was not someone covering his story.
I love to hear someone who's skilled in the ways of interrogations who can look at that. And you know, I'm sure, Robin, when you were first watching those videos, you probably didn't know a shit ton about the case.
No, my the first thing I saw really on guys was that interview. I knew about the case. I heard about it briefly. I was going to cover it on Tony's show. And the first thing I looked at was that interview of him with the cops. Yeah. And before I even knew anything else, I said, that's not someone who's guilty.
That's what I'm saying.
Nope.
I don't have nearly the skill set that you do with respect to being able to objectively look at an interview, but I do have the skill set of having dealt with defendants in criminal cases for decades to know what they typically look like when they're guilty and how they respond to questions without even getting into the, you know, kind of the body language aspect of it. I'm just listening to the words.
Yeah, me too. Believe it or not, body language can be extremely deceptive to people. Yeah. And I'm a whole picture kind of guy. Because it's very specific to the individual and you're looking for specificity of, and you're always trying to, and you do it as a lawyer. You're looking, what's the intent? What's the intent of the individual being interviewed and what's the intent of the interviewees?
Right.
You know, and the intent of Richard Allen, when he was in there, his intent was to be transparent. If he was feeling guilty in any way, his intent would not be transparency. It'd be obfuscating. It'd be maneuvering this way. And then when you look at the intent was with his phone calls with his wife, I keep going back to that. His intent was for her, not for self. Not for self-preservation, it's preservation for her. And then you get into the messy crap of the stupid confessions, which if anyone spent even half a quarter of a semester in college looking at social psychology, you'd be like, that is completely BS.
And that's what we're going to be getting into.
I know, in
our next segment.
Sorry.
It's amazing. It's amazing what you can do when you hold somebody in solitary for 13 months, even when the state has rules saying the limit's 30 days. It's amazing the magic that you can have happen. That's coming up next. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Be sure to weigh in there. The links are in the description. The Indiana Department of Correction has a written policy. Inmates with serious mental illness, the kind Richard Allen was documented as having before he ever went into Westville, are not supposed to be held in solitary confinement beyond 30 days. Richard Allen was there for 13 months. In that time, a man who arrived at 180 pounds dropped to 135. He stopped recognizing whether he was actually alive or not. He wasn't quite sure. He tore up his own legal mail. Then he confessed into a crime that really wasn't quite committed the way he confessed it. And there's a litany. He's eating his own poop. He's running headfirst into a wall. The state's argument on appeal is that none of this adds up to coercion. And a religious conversion is actually what explains the rest. Nothing to do with being run mad for 13 months. The collision between IDOC's own rulebook and what the state is now asking three judges to bless may be the biggest fight in this entire appeal. Bob Mata, defense attorney, is with us, host of the podcast Defense Diaries, and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Bob, the Indiana Department of Corrections own policy, it caps solitary at 30 days for inmates with mental illness. Allen's there 13 months. So this isn't Allen going, keep me in solitary, guys. I really think it's nifty. It's, you have no choice. You are there 13 months. It goes against their own damn policy. But a policy, as we've learned in so many cases, is a suggestion, a mere suggestion, a rule, maybe rule that's meant to be broken when there's not truly legislation or laws that that enforce said rules. I guess you can kind of do whatever you want. I mean, how does the state explain this to a three judges with a straight face without just saying, well, you know, it's a suggestion. We thought otherwise. Oh, Bob, your mic's off.
I was drinking coffee. I didn't want you to hear that.
Sure.
Clean the ice, my iced coffee. I mean, they relabel it. You know, what they call it is it was safekeeping.
They
were trying to keep Richard Allen alive because, you know, they couldn't have him out in Gen Pop because he's accused of killing two little girls. And we all know what happens to guys that do that in prison. They get got. So, I mean, that's the way that they would frame it. And that's the way that they have framed it. They've framed everything. Oh, he wasn't in solitary.
Mm-hmm.
He was in a single person cell. Yeah. You know,
just like drinking a cup of bleach is a refreshing cleansing experience.
Yeah, I mean, if you looked at the people that listen to podcasts like The Prosecutors or The Murder Sheet, and they're like, oh, well, he was treated better than the other people in Westville. Well, the other people in Westville were convicted felons. Mm-hmm. Like the part, like when I hear people say that, it shows such a gross misunderstanding of how this thing works. Anybody who's been arrested and then is charged and is going to stand trial is presumed innocent in this country. Period. End of conversation. Mm-hmm. I see people like, oh, well, that's a thing for the jurors. No, it's not. It's a mindset that as Americans, we need to understand, because the entire burden lays with the state. The defendant doesn't have to show anything. If the state is going to accuse you of something, it is their duty and their burden alone to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that you did that thing. So when you take a guy who's presumed innocent and you stick him in the most secure cell in the most secure prison in the state of Indiana and hold him away for 23 hours a day for 13 months, if you don't think that that's a problem, then I suggest you hole yourself up in your bathroom for 30 days and let yourself out for an hour a day to go into a 3x3 cage to talk to somebody who's ostensibly supposed to be helping you. But it turns out that that person is some kind of true crime weirdo who's a digger and was actively researching the case for the very person she's treating. Everything about what happened to Richard Allen should make your skin crawl if you live in this country. It should terrify you, because if that's what we're going to start doing with people, if you don't think that you would, because it's an issue of voluntariness. That's what the confessions come down to. This isn't when you're watching an old cop show and they have the light, you know, shining in your face and the cops screaming in your face and, you know, they have you in there for 18, 22 hours straight, no sleep, no food. They're not giving you anything to drink. This isn't that. This was far more serious. That's illegal. I mean, like this was something that was done in a way so that he would break mentally. And it's exactly what happened. He broke mentally. You know, and like I actually see people making comments that he was malingering, which means faking it.
There
are people that actually exist on the world, in this planet, in social media. They're like, oh, well, he was faking eating his own feces. He was trying to make himself seem crazy.
And those are what we call non-critical thinkers.
I mean, how do you argue with somebody like that?
You can't.
Because what is the end game for a guy pretending that he's crazy?
I know.
When you're not pleading insanity.
I want to understand. Like, where is that land? Like, okay, so you're claiming that he's faking, that he's gone insane. So, but to what end for him? Like, where is the malingering? Like, what does that bring to him if he's thought about this? Okay, like, are you thinking that he's going to – they were never going with an insanity defense. And the problem is, starting with the safekeeping order, from the very first time that this case was in court, after Judge Diener issued the arrest warrant and then recused himself because of the bloodlust – surrounding this case. So the initial judge steps back, but before he does, they go into court without giving Richard Allen notice, because the safekeeping is a statute. Okay. And the defendant has an absolute right to be present, or at least at the very least have his attorney present. They skulked in without Allen being there, without his attorney, and he did have an attorney at that time that had been paid, and it wasn't, Rosie or Baldwin or any of those guys. It was a lawyer that Kathy, his wife, had found. As soon as she found out that he was in custody, paid him money, and they skulk in, and this guy's reaching out to them, to the state, so they can't claim that they didn't know that he had counsel. Because the problem for the state on this safekeeping issue is that Richard Allen, if they're saying we're looking to keep you safe, we're not holding you away because we're worried about you hurting others. We're worried about you getting hurt. And there was no credible threat. It was just a feeling. It was that thing that I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Like, well, you know what they do to child killers in jail. That was their basis for it. So they skulk into court, and Richard Allen had the opportunity pursuant to the statute to say, you know what? I'm fine. I didn't do this. I don't need you to put me in Westville Penitentiary. I'll stay in the county jail. I'll take my chances with it. Because that was his option. That mm-hmm. would have been something. And when they didn't give him that due process, it becomes a major issue. And then what happens is that months go by. So when you hit the April and May dates after he's been in since whenever, November, and he's now exhibiting the signs of psychosis. Like, this is when he's eating his feces, smashing his head against the cell walls or the cell door. And they're filming
as the state calls it, finding religion.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, the way they waffled on that.
Yeah.
They said that he found God, or that it was as soon as he got his discovery and he knew that his goose was cooked, that's
between confessing. Between taking bites of the Bible and poop and drinking toilet water.
So, but like what happens in June? So he's already exhibiting all the psychosis. And so his lawyers go in June, and they had a safekeeping hearing in front of Judge Gull, and they put on the warden, they put on guards, they were showing pictures, and Nick McClelland's sitting there literally calling the defense liars. And at that point, they didn't have everything that they had at trial. They didn't have all the videos. They didn't have all of that. They had pictures that they took of Rick Allen, and they had stories that Rick was telling them as to what was going on, because they wouldn't let them tour the prison. They wouldn't let them look, and I'm talking about them being his attorneys, what his cell and his confinement conditions were. They had no idea. So all they're hearing from is their client. Well, it turns out that everything that they were saying at that hearing was absolutely true. And the bigger issue was that Cass County, which is a county that is 10 minutes away from one of his attorney's offices, and still instead of 2 hours or 2+ hours to go visit his client for his massive trial that's coming up, where they're filming every single interaction he has with his attorneys. And Gull denies it, even though the sheriff for Cass County said, yeah, we don't want him, but we could take him. We can handle him because it's a newer facility. And Gull denies it. So he ends up sitting in there, and this is after he's already gone psychotic. But the state knows that he's gone psychotic. The state was privy to those videos and to the fact that he was eating his own feces. And like, where's the morality in that?
Where's the culpability too? I mean, and that's what I've been looking up right now. I'm looking for the
started on that, because the lawsuit, the civil rights lawsuit, was never even filed.
That's what it's befuddling, because I'm looking up, you know, inmates that are already convicted versus inmates that aren't convicted, threats to them. And yeah, you're right, Bob. You know, they had, according to their policy, the right to segregate them. But now I'm looking up, you know, well, what if they're displaying that mental instability because of the confinement? And so where's their culpability for you see and are witness to and actually know the actions he's taken, not in his own best interest or in his own best health? I mean, he basically is hurting himself, potentially committing suicide by bad things he's doing to himself. You know, what are you going to do about that? And where's their culpability for that behavior?
I mean, it feels like there's none. It feels more like it's like, well, if you think he's faking it, then he must be faking it because you feel that.
Incapable. So I feel like, so let's 13 just, months let's, yeah, incapable of faking.
The checks and balances don't exist there for any of this. And then when you get really, you know, unethical, shitty people in these positions.
Here it is.
This
is I got is, it.
What you got?
So bottom line, facilities must evaluate, treat, and absent narrow exceptions, remove the inmate from solitary once SMI or significant instability is confirmed. Failure to act can lead to lawsuits or unconstitutional conditions. These steps are not discretionary once decompensation is documented. They are required by current IDOC policies, and it cited it, and federal constitutional standards for the most current facility. So yeah, they were legally obligated to do something about it.
Well, and there was a lawsuit, the IPASS lawsuit.
Yeah.
And it was a settlement. It settled, and that's where those rules were laid out.
How did they get around it?
They just ignored it. They just didn't. What do you mean? They just ignored it. Well, they pretended like it didn't exist. They didn't give a shit. That's the kind of thing where if you're a serious person and if you care about the health of our judicial system and our criminal justice system,
yes,
in this country, you should care about this. Yeah. Like put aside everything else. Put aside the facts of the case and just think about if we think that that's okay. What was done to him was a war crime.
Yeah.
Like unequivocally, if we treated prisoners of war the way that they treated Richard Allen, those are absolute war crimes.
Yeah.
And this is a guy, again, who I'm going to say was presumed innocent.
And so as I know one of the listeners chimed in and said, you know, Gitmo much. You know, even in situations where Guantanamo Bay, the military is trying to use the excuse of not being U.S. persons or U.S. citizens. And yet that still got outlawed and banned, doing things just like this. Just solitary, let alone waterboarding, all the other crap they're accused of. But literally, just solitary like this was outlawed and banned. And it's just like this. And that's for non-U.S. persons, non-U.S. citizens. This is a U.S. person, U.S. citizen.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of insane. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. There's more to come. Oral arguments at the Indiana Court of Appeals are described as rare, but frequently granted when one side asks for them. One side here is asking. The other side would clearly rather the panel, you know, this just sits in a file room somewhere. That split, who wants to be in the room and who doesn't, might be the loudest signal yet about how this appeal is actually positioned. Bob Mata, defense attorney, is with Robin and myself as we continue to break down the chaos of Richard Allen's chaos. Delphi case. Bob, the defense filed for oral arguments. The state did not. One side wants to stand in front of three judges. And you said early in our conversation, it's probably going to happen, but it's brief. The other would rather, you know, they decided on paper. Where does this take us? What is the timeline going forward for oral arguments, if they're to take place, and just kind of give us an idea of really next steps here. Where could we possibly be turning the pages in this choose your own adventure book in the coming months?
So ultimately, what's going to happen is the briefs have been all submitted. It's fully briefed. That's how they define it at this point. All the briefs are done. Now the justices that are going to be sitting on this case are reading them, and at some point in the next probably 2 months, they'll set an oral argument date. And people that I, you know, I'm friendly with that practice in Indiana are telling me early fall is when we can expect to have the oral arguments take place. And then once oral arguments happen, it could be another 2, 3, 4 months after that before we get an opinion or a decision on it. So, I mean, I think we're talking earliest, maybe around Christmas, you know, that we get some kind of decision on this thing. And, you know, and then what happens is if the appellate court turns around and says, okay, well, you know, we hear you, you know, there were some good arguments that were made by the defense. However, we're hanging our hat on waiver. You know, if we didn't find that your arguments were compelling enough, that you waived all these issues, unfortunately, we don't have to get to the merits. So
if they make that decision, why? Is it convenience? Is it because they're wanting to really parse out the letter of the law and get to the truth here? Or how are they making their choice on this if, in fact, they just side with the state and say, no, everything's great, even clearly when it has not? Is it just another court punting it down to the next court so it goes to the Supreme Court so they don't have to deal with it? Sort of like we saw earlier on in this when it went to, what's her name, shortly after Gull. I can't think of her name. Where it's just, we're going to punt this down to the next court. I'm not going to truly deal with any of this myself.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what it would be, you know.
Then why do we have all these courts if nobody wants to do their freaking jobs?
I mean, that's a million-dollar question.
It's, you know, unfortunately, this, now we'll go to the laws of human nature here. It's,
yes.
I've been inside, as and I know Bob's been around these government types too. I don't care whether it's local, state, or federal. you know, I dealt with an entire career of you have some people that are doing the righteous work because it's the right thing to do, because it's the right thing to do. Unfortunately, you also have people that are, it's everything's a dichotomy, right? A dichotomy between self and others. Those that are balancing hardcore on others, which is the righteous work about, you know, good processes, good law, good procedures, because it wants to be just, it wants to be fair. Those are people doing the righteous work. But these people are also balancing it with self, career, relationships, preservations of titles, positions, promotions. And when you have the self outweighing the other, that's when this shit happens. That's why it keeps getting punted sometimes. Now, granted, if it's a righteous punt because it's the right process, procedure, oh, great. But a lot of times I've been around this. I've had to strategize operational improvement for things, basically waiting because I knew this guy would approve it, but not execute it because it would potentially damage his career. He'd wait for the next guy to come in who can then blame the last guy, but could take action on it, then blame the last guy. I mean, inside government, you're constantly working the dichotomies of people and trying to figure out where they are. And that's unfortunately how the sausage is made on some of these cases. And unfortunately, it looks like it might be going on here. Not accusing anyone of anything.
Yeah, I mean, that's gospel, you know, and ultimately, I mean, I'm going to feel a certain kind of way if they end up punting it on the waiver bullshit. You know, it's one thing for them to get to the merits and then, you know, uphold the conviction. At least there they did the work. You know, at least I thought that was, I could say, all right, well, I disagree, but it was an intellectually honest attempt at addressing the issues. If they punted based on the waiver, I don't feel like that. I'm like, wow, man, like they just took the easy way out. They won't even get to the things that matter about this case, the things that actually have substance, the things that we need to address moving forward in the criminal justice system. Like, these are things that have to be looked at because we need to figure out whether or not, if these things are happening during a pretrial and a trial, does it amount to a person getting a fair trial? Like, if you don't get to those issues, you're never going to get an answer in this case. So, but again, like I base a lot of what I say in terms of how they operate in Indiana, in terms of the appellate court, based on what lawyers that I respect a whole hell of a lot that practice in that state are telling me what to expect. And I have, there's some varying opinions. You know, one of my favorite lawyers there, she's of the opinion that she thinks that the appellate court might do the right thing here. My other friend, who I really, really respect as well, he thinks that ultimately it's going to get kicked up to the Indiana Supreme Court and they're going to be the ones to do the right thing. Both of them feel, having both practiced in habeas work and appellate law in Indiana for a very long time and have been very successful at it, feel that this thing has a really good shot at getting him a new trial. They both feel like that, and they understand the politics that surround this case, mm-hmm. because that's a part of this piece of the puzzle that you cannot forget exists.
Absolutely.
You know, you've got Todd Rokita, who's the attorney general. They have a vested interest in keeping this conviction in place.
Yeah.
You know, the state of Indiana has a vested interest in keeping this conviction in place. The prosecutor's office in Carroll County has a vested interest. You know, Indiana State Police, they all want this conviction to stick.
This is a great example of the state as a whole working in tandem together.
It's like, that's what I'm always telling people. That is the government.
Yeah.
Whenever I'm screaming about the government, it's them. It's all of those people.
And what's interesting is,
and Bob, go ahead, Tony. What's interesting is
all these different parts and pieces seemingly working together harmoniously to keep Richard Allen at bay and the truth of the story at bay, because it doesn't benefit them. It's amazing, quite honestly, because the government never can do that. They can never keep all their plates spinning, but they keep doing it because they all have a vested interest in the truth not coming out and Richard Allen not suing the living shit out of all of them. And
and making millions of dollars at the end of the day, which could very likely happen. I kind of feel like they're more so weighing him out to death, where, well, he's already mentally compromised. Let's put him here. Let's not let anybody see him. Let's not talk about him. And eventually he'll die. And when he dies, well, no, yeah, the odds of us having to face the consequences for any of this or be held accountable significantly go down. Or if we do, it's significantly lower than what it would be if there's not the media circus of him walking out of prison one day and into a mansion with millions of dollars that he'll have because of the wrongful conviction. It just seems a scratch your back, I'll scratch mine is alive and well through the departments of Indiana.
Robin, I know you had some.
Yeah, no, because I just want to highlight the beautiful phrase you keep saying on a lot of our shows, Bob, and that is do the work. You know, and that's the simplest test ever. If someone can poke this many holes in what was done, then you didn't do the work. And when someone's life is on the line and their freedom is on the line, shame on you for not doing the work. That is complete laziness and self-centered. Because think about this. Why wouldn't someone want to do the work? Because it impacts them.
Oh, God, and dude.
And it's spot on. It was just the simplest phrase ever. And if you don't want to do the work, get the F out of the job because you're not meant for it.
If he gets a new trial, which I am of the firm belief he absolutely deserves, and he has walked, if he's found not guilty, because what happens in appeal is those errors that they made the first time are fixed. So that means a third party culprit defense comes in. That means that if they're going to allow these confessions, if they find that they were actually voluntary and they allow some of them in and they say, okay, but here's the thing, the one where the defense was trying to get in through the completeness doctrine, the phone call that preceded the one where he's saying, I feel like I'm in Guantanamo Bay.
Oh, you mean in context?
Yeah, the context of everything, you know, and they're like, but we're going to play that before they hear the rest of it, you know, because we're talking about hundreds of hours and they cherry picked, you know, maybe 5 minutes mm-hmm. of sound out of hundreds of hours of whatever Richard Allen was rambling about, which obviously include things about shooting the girls and the girls weren't shot, you know, about starting World War III, about, you know, like all the terrible things that he was just puking out of his diseased mind. None of that was heard by the jury, and it doesn't necessarily mean that it'll ever will be. But if all of the issues are fixed and he gets a fair trial and he's walked out by a not guilty, imagine the abject horror that the state of Indiana, that the Indiana State Police, that the prosecutors, mm-hmm. that all of those people are going to be feeling, because when the Patty family comes in knocking and they're mm-hmm. saying, hey, they walked him. Like, I thought you told me he was the right guy. We believed he was the right guy. Who are we going after now?
Yep.
And you know what? They're going to have victims to throw their hands up, because they can't turn around and go after the Brad Holders and the Elvis Fields, because they're on record saying they didn't do it. We investigated that thoroughly. They have fucked this case up beyond all recognition from beginning to end. And the people that are paying the price, ultimately, if that happens, the victims' families.
Yep, victims'
families. Which I've been screaming about since the day I started covering.
100%.
And the people on the other side, the murder sheet fucks and the prosecutors tried to turn it on me like, oh, he doesn't, like, he's supporting a child. No, I'm trying to explain to people that deserve to know, because the prosecutors aren't explaining to them that the process is being bastardized. What they're doing now, what the judge is doing now, is not the way it's supposed to work. And ultimately what this is going to result in is a second trial that you're going to have to sit through. And God forbid that it goes through from your perspective, because you bought what you've been sold by the state. Most victims' families do. The law enforcement comes to them. The prosecutor comes to them and says, hey, we got the guy. This is on lock. I want you to rest easy. You have nothing to worry about. We've done the work here. This is the person. They're going to pay the price for what they did to your girls. And they believe it. People need to be able to believe that. They have to.
Yeah.
And when that turns out to not be the case, It's a nightmare scenario. And like this, you want to kill the messenger, and me being the messenger, that something stinks about this case. I don't know how long I had to say that something stinks in Delphi for it to finally hit the mark with somebody. Because I've asked every single person that's on the opposite side of this thing to come onto my show and debate me. Let's go. I've got the facts on my side. You've got a bunch of just narrative-driven drivel that's not actual evidence of a crime being committed by this individual. And it's that simple.
Because like, you did the work, Bob. You're doing the work, and they're not. Man, there you go.
Yeah, it's a frustrating case for me. But all wrongful conviction cases are frustrating for me. Because you have people, there are actually, again, people that exist in the world that don't think that wrongful convictions are a thing, which is so fucking bizarre to me.
Yeah. I'm like,
we're talking about, you know, police departments where guys went to an academy for 6 months, maybe. Maybe they have a bachelor's degree. We're not talking about like armies of monks and Columbos out there that are solving cases, man. Like, yeah. It's not how this shit works.
It's like somebody saying, fire's not hot. It just makes my marshmallows toasty. like no, it's fucking hot. You just didn't put your hand in it yet. Wow. Your thoughts in the comment section in Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in on this. And of course, we will continue to cover this as it continues to evolve. Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries. Go check it out. And his other podcast,
Buried Inside the John Wayne Gacy Investigation. It's a good one.
It's available wherever you get podcasts. Go check it out. Bob's podcast and also on YouTube. Go check it out. And Robin Drake, It's Not All About Me, his latest book. Go and check it out. Available wherever books are sold.
And leave a review, please.
Yes, and leave a review, too. And for me, just press subscribe wherever you're listening. Greatly appreciate that. Until next time, for Bob, for Robin, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
From ESPN's 30 for 30 podcast, this is Murder at the U.
Did you say someone got shot?
November 2006, a college football star on his way to NFL dreams, gunned down in broad daylight.
Just bawling, crying, and he said, Coach, they killed him.
No weapon, missing witnesses, conflicting accounts, and for years, no arrest.
She insinuated that the Miami PD had done nothing, and it became a little bit more accusatory.
The case goes cold, rumors spread, and the truth gets buried. Until now.
His world could come crashing down. According to him, it was over.
The ending, something no one saw coming. Because this story isn't over yet. From ESPN's 30 for 30 podcast, this is Murder at the U. Binge the full season right now, wherever you get your podcasts.